Okay, welcome to the Bitcoin Gauntlet, episode 5 with Planta. How are you doing today?
Good mate, how are you?
Pretty good. So, Planta, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm new to Bitcoin, and I will always be. It really changed me. It's a fantastic thing. To the point that I really want to dedicate my more of my life to it. Just meet more Bitcoiners and keep on learning, going down the rabbit hole.
Same here. That's one of the main reasons why I started this podcast, try and meet some new Bitcoiners, have some interesting discussions. So, for you and for the audience, the Bitcoin Gauntlet, Planta here will be presented with three categories to pick from. He'll pick one, and then from there, he'll be presented with three prompts. He'll pick one and we'll discuss them. The prompts are designed to be maximally divisive, some more so than others. And then he will choose to either argue in the affirmative or the negative for those prompts. We'll have a little bit of a discussion. Maybe I'll chime in a little bit, have some counter arguments. We'll see. We'll do that for 4 rounds, and that'll be it. So, Planta, are you ready?
Let's do
All right. Round one, we have Austrian economics, mining, or miscellaneous?
Let's go with miscellaneous.
Miscellaneous, okay. Number one, stablecoins on Taro slash Lightning will lead to a contentious hard fork. Number two, the Chinese government stands more to lose from Bitcoin's monetization than the US government. Or three, the biggest impediment to understanding Bitcoin is Stockholm syndrome.
I think I'll go with Trey. It's just interesting. And I would go with with it in the negative.
Okay.
I think that the biggest difficulty to understand Bitcoin is that people don't know money. If you don't know how money works, and there are incentives for governments and big institutions for the population to not understand it, you won't. There is no real incentive, so people will see the opportunity or what they miss by not understanding Bitcoin. It's just such a completely different reality and a different perception of what money is, how society should function, how money should be spent. All of those changes, all that framework is completely different for someone that already understood Bitcoin, or not understood completely, but at least spent a substantial amount of time studying what Bitcoin is, opposite to people that never understood money. For probably certain group of economists, Austrian economists, if they are not Bitcoiners, they had a different perception and certain level of education on what money could be, opposite to what is given to us by culture and the government and a bit of education of what money currently is. As I said to you before, I grew up in South America. I was born in Argentina, and I lived broken money. I lived in my generation. We changed from currencies twice. Just before I was born, we had hyperinflation to the point that the prices would change substantially through the day. Not through the months, through the day, like 30% in a day. And that is not a mistake, in my opinion. It's hard to consider that after people being super smart and studying in big universities about finance and economics, they make the same mistakes that were made 20, 50 years ago. So going back to it, people don't want to lie to themselves. People just don't see how money works and that there is a better alternative. I just don't think it's, yeah, Stockholm syndrome.
Okay, so maybe to argue the other side a little bit, and maybe to your point, sometimes we say that understanding Bitcoin, like Bitcoin is everything people don't know about money multiplied by everything people don't know about computers,
Totally.
something like that.
Yes.
But then what is really the obstacle for them to understand? Because maybe I could make the case that at least in the Western world, we've been inundated with propaganda about money and intellectually, spiritually corralled by the central banks and misinformed to the point where maybe I might be so impoverished that for me to step out of bounds and wrong think is too scary to question the nature of money, because if you start to question the nature of money, you may, as probably everybody listening to this podcast has done, completely change and radicalize your life. So maybe there's some apprehension to questioning the nature of money and going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, because maybe you subconsciously know that something's wrong, and it's safer to just trust your captors than take that risk.
Totally. I mean, like everyone wants to have friends and fit in society. It's part of us. We are social beings. You don't want to be the weirdo living in a cave, like talking to the sun in the mornings and saying, Jim, Jim, Jim. No, it's like we are a bunch of weirdos. And as I was saying to you before, in Australia, there is this movement, the Bitcoin Bush Bash. And going, for me, going there and meeting other people that are crazy like me, it just validated a lot of what I was thinking and making me feel that maybe I'm not that wrong. Maybe I'm not the only one that has these ideas. There is a bunch of other people that think that the world could be a better place just by adopting Bitcoin. And as I told you a few minutes ago, it's not a panacea. It's not going to solve every problem that we have, but it's a very good spot to start. And I don't see many other good spots to start at this point. I think it's the best thing we have by far.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a great source of hope and optimism. Maybe sometimes we catch too much flack for being pessimistic or doomers, maybe by some outsiders. But I generally find that Bitcoiners are pretty optimistic, actually,
Yes.
because we've seen, I mean, optimistic for the big picture, because we've seen firsthand for ourselves what the positive impact that it's had on our lives in all sorts of ways. Personal development, your sovereignty, your increases your courage, your health, your relationships, on and on and on. So okay, anything else to say on that one, or would you like to move on?
No, I think I said enough.
Okay.
Yeah.
Round two, we have adoption, Bitcoin culture, and Noster.
I love Noster. Let's go with Noster.
It's a pretty popular one. And I changed it around a little bit. So, number one, Noster helps Bitcoin adoption more than Bitcoin helps Noster adoption. Number two, fiat celebrities using Noster will increase Noster adoption more than censorship will. Or number three, the biggest risk to Noster is that it will fall into the centralization trend, the same centralization trend as email and today's social media sites.
I go with the first one. Noster helps Bitcoin adoption more than Bitcoin helps Noster adoption. Personally, it's been almost 2.5 years, almost 3, I think, that I've been on Noster. And when I got into the protocol, there was just not much really going on. The clients that most people were using was Astral Ninja. I think Iris appears soon after that, and Damos, and I don't know if Amethyst was around then, but yeah, Damos was working on mobile. It was crazy, and it helped me understand a lot more about Bitcoin, about keepers. As I said to you before, my background is not IT or finance, so I struggled a lot at the beginning to understand up to the point that I do now. Bitcoin. Just using key pairs for something that wasn't a monetary transaction, and it was just like signing a note to prove validity of what I was saying and when I was saying it. It helped me understand more about Bitcoin. It gave me a certain level of how can we say confidence, to use the protocol, to be able to see it from a different perspective. Now, generalizing it or saying it in this in it as the phrase was, Noster helps Bitcoin adoption more than Bitcoin helps Noster adoption. I don't know, it's very early. Noster as a protocol is very early, has a very limited amount of people, even though a lot of people maybe come in, not that many people stay. There is just a bunch of accounts using the protocol, and a bunch of apps. Some of those apps are being developed ongoingly, some of those apps are not, like they died, Astral Ninja being one of the examples. I think that time will tell on this one. It's a difficult thing, but I think that both of them will go together really well, and they will continue going together in the future.
I think they mesh together very nicely. So let's see. Noster helping Bitcoin. I guess maybe with younger generations, like people who've been digitally native for longer and mobile phone, smartphone native for longer, their first touch point with Bitcoin might be through social media. If we get to a point where most people aren't buying Bitcoin, they're earning it, that will probably be through Noster, but then again, hard to say how long that'll take to get to that point. And then as far, yeah.
I have young kids, and I am not gonna let them go to Noster or use Noster for quite a few more years. It's a wild west. It reminds me a lot of the early internet where you could go absolutely everywhere. There was no payment method for websites. You could just, go and access. There was no need to create accounts. I'm talking about like in the 90s, that part of the internet. I think it's a bit, yeah, you need to be at least 15 or older to use Noster as it is now, unless there are some filters in the future where you can filter content in a much better way to be suitable for a person that is around 10 or 12, if that is something that some parents are interested in. I think it's, yeah, it's a bit too wild at the moment to consider that kids or young people are going to start using Noster as a social media. But I'm sure that maybe some parents will. It's probably a matter of time.
Perhaps there may be other applications for Noster, other types of like micropayments for websites and services that people will use. That'll be a touch point, 'cause right now the low hanging fruit for us is like a Twitter social media type clone, but that's not the only application for Noster or use case.
No, totally. No.
So maybe as more people spend even more time online and maybe doing more of their jobs, perhaps in content, more of their jobs are digitally native, that may be more of an impetus for them to have a touch point with Bitcoin as their payment versus like doing Bitcoin and then Noster. I'm trying to figure out what. Where do the main flows come? Is it from Bitcoin first and then to Noster, or from Noster first and then to Bitcoin?
At the moment, I think it's quite clear that it's from Bitcoin to Noster.
Right.
Also, I mainly follow Bitcoiners. I don't follow accounts that are usually not Bitcoiners. So it's hard for me to tell from my own little bubble how things are. But I have the feeling that most people that use the protocol and stay in it are Bitcoiners. There was a point in which CBD was bringing a lot of people, but CBD disappeared. as a master client. I think it disappeared. I don't know. Maybe it's still going. But then it was also quite weird because of the way of how they were managing the NSEC for those accounts. It's not a services a service that I would have used.
Okay, one more question for my own curiosity here. Do you think there will be any kind of surge event for Nostr usage? And if so, what do you think that event might be? Or do you think it's just a gradual, or if there's any kind of jump, sudden jump, like what do you think that might be?
At the end of the day, people choose things that work. That's how things go. It's like if this is giving answers to your questions, if this is solving problems, and if this thing that you're wanting to choose is actually reliable, work most of the time, more and more people will adopt it. That's how things go. Adoption is not instant. And yes, there are things that will push adoption, usually based on needs, on people's needs. So what does Nostr solve? It gives the possibility of not being censored. That's the main value. Now, is censorship an issue for most people? Most people want things to be convenient and relatively easy. People don't want to spend 3 hours setting up relays. Most people don't want to run an appliance in their house to store their own nodes. People will get really upset if the relays where they were storing their nodes get nuked and they lose the nodes that are 3 years old. They get really upset about that. So it's about finding that element, that point where we, I hate this, but socially engineer the necessity for people to start using this better protocol. There is no Nostr marketing team. We are the Nostr marketing team. The developers are up to a point, the Nostr marketing team too. We need to show maybe or explain or create these solutions for the majority of the people and a reason why they would move to Nostr. There are a lot of complexities to it. It's so convenient if I don't remember my password that I can reset it, get a new password or a link to reset my password on my phone, even if I'm like 5,000 kilometers of my house. That is convenient and people love convenience.
Yeah, it's still early days, very, very early, and there's a lot of work to be done. So, all right,
Gonna
let's move.
happen though.
Yeah, all right, let's move on to round three. We have protocol upgrades, political philosophy, and network slash consensus.
I choose to. No, I'm joking. Because of who am I, I'm gonna choose political philosophy, but I just want to make a really quick comment on maybe protocol upgrades with everything that's going on at the moment with OP return and the fight between, let's say, nodes and core. I like Bitcoin as money. I never came into this space for JPEGs or smart contracts. I think that some smart contracts could be good. My background is not technical, but I don't think that covenants are the best solution, even though many smarter people than me say that it is. I like Bitcoin as more or less it is now. But yeah, I'm gonna go with political philosophy. Let's get that.
Okay, we may be able to parlay that into this. We'll see. Number one, on a Bitcoin standard, monarchy is preferable to democracy. Number two, strategic reserves are immoral because everything the state has is stolen. Or three, Bitcoin is not democratic, and that's okay.
I'm gonna go with three. Bitcoin is not democratic, and that's okay. Democracy as we have it now, it's a very weird system. A lot of people love it. We went through elections in Australia recently, federal elections. People are happy with making a decision once every 4 years and then, like, that's it. My hands are clean. I've done my duty. I'm like, motherfucker, go outside your duties every day. You live in this society all the time. It just shocks me how people consider society. I travel a lot around the world, so and I can. It's not that I love any particular place. I just love everywhere. So at this point, I don't have a sense of nationalism. I love the place when I'm standing, the neighborhood, the people that I'm surrounded with, the people that provide services to me in the same way that I expect that if I provide services or goods to someone else, they will love me for being part of that community and for creating that culture. Now, the democracy is not what it used to be. Direct democracy, I think it was a beautiful thing where people sat down regularly to discuss how the government should function. And they were part effectively of the government. Now, the government teaches while we are at school that we are part of it, that through democracy we have the possibility to decide on things. No, we don't. No, we don't, to the point that most times democracy, mathematically speaking, is not even the majority of the population choosing a person to dictate rules for 4 years. There is, I think, a really good video by Veritasium on YouTube that explained the mathematics behind democracy. If you haven't seen it, give it a look. It's super entertaining and it explains how usually a lot of prime ministers and presidents are chosen with way less than 50% of the population choosing them to be there. On top of that, you put the fact that you do this only every 4 years. What is it that you're really choosing? Furthermore, most countries' parties are usually bilateral, so there is usually two main parties in most countries in the world. Both parties are getting closer and closer ideologically in most countries of the world. It's not really much of a choice. And when you start talking with people, and even though I hate politicians and politics, I talked a lot about it. When you talk to people about politics and choosing things, they usually end up choosing the one that is the least worse. That's not a choice. That is fact. I think I went a bit on a rant, and I'm sorry. Going back to Bitcoin is not democratic, and that's okay. Yeah, Bitcoin is not democratic. I thought there was some, like, we talked a lot about a consensus mechanism. A consensus mechanism is not democracy. At the beginning, I made a mistake of considering that there was some sort of democratic process. But no, it's a consensus process. It's a way that people act on what software they are running and which rules they choose to run, depending on that software. That we all end up agreeing on something, but it's nothing like democracy. It's more like people getting shoved in a room for a year until they make a decision. Not everyone will be happy. Most people will be exhausted, but we'll come to some sort of consensus where we all still do the Bitcoin thing, to call it somehow. Bitcoin is not democratic. Democracy is a human thing. Bitcoin is math and electricity. And that's okay.
So I put this in here because I've often heard in popular media and sometimes in some looser podcasts that Bitcoin is democratic when basically in our common vernacular, democracy equal good. So anytime you can just attach democracy to something, it makes it sound like it's better. But in this case, what about I would see democracy as tyranny of the majority. So if you apply that to Bitcoin, maybe what I was trying to get at maybe here was maybe more about the nodes. So I can run an older version of Bitcoin and be totally fine. And other people running other versions, newer versions of Bitcoin doesn't prevent me from running my older version of Bitcoin. And so I don't know if you had maybe have anything to add to that. Maybe you can explain better to the audience about that process than I can.
I appreciate the fact that, and I hope that it will always be backwards compatible, so you can always run your older version. Choose not to get some features. For example, you can choose to run a version that doesn't include all the upgrades that happen with SegWit. And unfortunately, that will make you pay bigger fees. If you're using main chain, probably, I don't know. I assume that you won't be able to start like a channel to Lightning services, but that's your choice. So that's up to you. Bitcoin is backwards compatible. You will still be able to broadcast transactions from your node. Your wallets obviously will be looking at slightly different than other wallets, but that's okay. That is not democracy, though. That is the possibility to choose which rules you choose from a system. In democracy, you don't choose which rules to use. You have to use the rules they give you, or you pay a fine, or you go to jail, or you get killed, depending on what democracy you're living in. Bitcoin gives you the opportunity to choose things as long as they are part of the consensus. Now, do you want the consensus to be let everyone host monkey pictures on everyone's computer because someone can? Don't know if I agree with that. I love experimenting and I love hoarding data. I get it. But I didn't come here for that. I came here to find money that I can trust, that gives me hope for the future, that I can pass on to my kids. I didn't come here for the monkey pictures. And I hope that most people see that. I hope that for the sake of filling up blocks, we don't put bullshit on the blockchain. And I told you before we started, like a 4 terabyte drive is not, that difficult to acquire for most Bitcoiners that I know, or even an 8 terabyte hard drive. It might be a cumbersome and annoying to update your node, open the case, and put the hard drive in there. But it's doable. And it's important that we start making those decisions and investing that time and not just letting Bitcoin Core make the decisions or nodes, whoever. Like, we need to be a bit more diligent and spend time in the same way that we need to spend time in our society. We cannot rely on the, oh, every 4 years I'm going to go and do the democracy thing. That's not how things work. That is being detached, not having a proper incentive, and just, oh, I pay taxes so they can manage things for me. You cannot run a business like that. You cannot say, oh, I pay my employees so they are going to have my interest on my business while they run it. No, that's not going to happen. They're going to steal from you. And that's what happens when you do that with the government. If you every 4 years say, oh, I did this thing, now I'm free for 4 years, you don't even deserve not to be stolen from because you allowed it. I don't want to keep going out of the government. This is a Bitcoin podcast. Let's go back to that.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I'd say Bitcoin protects the minority from the majority. In this case, it protects the smallest minority, which is the individual. I'd add that the block size war is a good example of how a minority, in a certain sense, a minority kind of won. I mean, in the block size war, the big blockers had most of the hash. They had the biggest producers of the miners. They had most of the exchanges, a lot of the developer share, and but the majority of the nodes didn't go with the big blocks. And ultimately, there are many different components of how Bitcoin might change, and different actors. Lynn Alden and Steve Lee wrote a really good piece on this maybe 6 months ago or so, talking
Yes, I saw
about
it.
the nodes. You got the nodes, you got the miners, you have the companies, you have the developers, a couple other different parties, and how they all have different kind of roles to play and different levels of power that kind of balance each other out. So.
Definitely. Link it to the notes of the article because if someone has of the pod, because if someone has not seen it, worth giving it a look. It's long, has a lot of charts. It goes all over the place, but it's one of those things that there will be a few highlights in there that will enlighten a lot of people.
Yeah, I listened to a couple of podcasts with them about it, and I felt a lot better after listening to them about that. That I felt m much more confident about Bitcoin after that. So, all right, last round, final round, round four. We have Austrian economics, regulation, and miscellaneous.
Okay, I'm not really good at Austrian economics. Let's go with that.
Oh, okay. Alrighty. Austrian economics. Number one, Bitcoin is not a parentheses inflation hedge. Number two, fiat money in the 20th century was inevitable, and therefore no politician or government are to blame for fiat's emergence. Or number three, Bitcoin prevents hyperinflation by gradually deflating the bond market.
I obviously don't know much about Austrian economics because I'm just finding it hard to fully understand these sentences. I think I'm gonna go with number two. Fiat money in the 20th century was inevitable, and therefore no politician or government are to blame for fiat's emergence. And I'm gonna go with that in the sense of like, yeah, that's total bullshit. Fiat money, it's not inevitable. Fiat money only, I think in the few thousand years of recorded history, fiat money didn't happen most of the time. It only happened a few times. And usually when fiat money happened, from the little bit I know, it started to promote wars. And killing of peoples and unnecessary aggressive behaviors and the very bad part of social engineering. I think that definitely politicians, bankers, people with a lot of power are to blame for the development of fiat money. I think that fiat currencies are not let's say natural development of money as a way of communicating value. Most people will not choose the characteristics of fiat money if they understand what money is and how it works. They will never choose the characteristics that fiat money provides. People want hard money. When you explain that to someone, people will generally choose to save the in gold if they had the opportunity to. But it's cumbersome, it's a bit complicated. It's much easier to have your dollars, your pesos, your yens in a bank account. It's convenient. You can produce yield between brackets now. So going back to the question, I read a few months ago, The Creature of Jekyll Island, and I had to go back and forth in a few of the bits and pieces. I'm not gonna say that the book should be a Bible. There are a lot of like jumps, in the sense of like theoretical jumps, like, oh, this then this and this happened, therefore this is a solution to it. Now, I don't want to say conspiracy theories, but there are a few things there that might not be fully correlated. Now, the whole thesis of the book and what is explained there has a lot of basis for me to once again know that money is broken. The Creature of Jekyll Island explains it fairly clearly and with a lot of evidence that man is manipulated. It's not okay. And it's been manipulated for years by very powerful people, people that have the possibility to manipulate hundreds of thousands or millions of people. That disbalance of power is not really okay. But it happens. It always did. Society always had leaders. That always happened. And that's why I like Bitcoin. It takes that power of some of them. It starts leveling the game. It stops people printing paper to then fund wars and bomb children. I don't want to pay taxes to bomb kids in the other side of the world. That's not me. There's a bunch of people that I hope they're in hell for creating fiat currencies, for proposing them, for trying to oppress most of the world, and basically from training them and myself from the wealth that they could have created by creating money and currency that just disappears, loses value for making us use this fucked up way of communicating between each other. Just broken money.
Yeah. So to maybe try and argue from the other side, what would you say about fiat money being the result of gold failing as money, as gold as a technological failure as money, that, and this is more or less Lynn Alden's broken money thesis, I'll adapt it, that our pace of communication via the transatlantic cables and the telegraph made it much better to not move the gold around, and that gold was always going to fail. I mean, at least on our planet. Maybe there might be under different circumstances in a different planet that the lag time between gold's failure and the discovery or creation, depending on your perspective, of absolute scarcity and a Bitcoin, that there was always going to be a lag time between when we had the basic, like, early electric communications and then the sufficient building blocks to creating a digital scarcity like Bitcoin.
It comes back to the needs and what we were talking about before in Nosta. If you do not have the need to create Bitcoin because you have gold and it's been functioning, and the way that commerce works around the environment where gold was used as money was fast enough. Now, when you need to go through the Atlantic, and you need to transport that gold to make payments, and the internet already exists. Yes, you will need something else. But until that need doesn't happen, people are not motivated to create Bitcoin. Satoshi put together a lot of things, not everything he did, and we all know that. Not everything he created was original. What was original was the fact of combining all of those other technologies, putting it into a packet kind of thing, to call it somehow, and then telling other people in the industry, hey guys, I made this thing. What do you think? That's how, like, and from there on, it changed a lot. Like, I only recently read that it was actually an exe file. I thought that he was programming on using Linux or something. He was using Windows. Interesting on the side. I also, going back to what you were saying, I think that is not a coincidence. I think that there was people actually interested in manipulating society. I believe that it was not a natural evolution as nature evolves species. There was human interest and intention on creating fiat currencies because it's much easier to manipulate than gold, or than something like Bitcoin that is effectively scarce and not managed by anyone or any central authority. I totally disagree with point number two, and I don't think that anyone will make me change my mind. Not
right,
even Nick.
maybe I'll try one more time. That that the incentives were there to create the central bank, that even if the attempt in 1913 failed, they still could have tried again, and there's really nothing to stop anyone from departing from the gold standard because they had the gold already concentrated, and it was just getting more and more concentrated. So the incentives were just there that it was always going to happen. So whether they did it in 1913 or not, whether they did it in 1913 or maybe if they failed 1915 or 1920, we were so far away from the necessary technological components of Bitcoin that there was sufficient time for them to just completely abandon the gold standard.
But you talked about the incentives there. What, in your opinion, were the incentives? I'm sorry, I'm asking you a question. This is your podcast. But what were the incentives that you believe that the people that created the central banks as we know them today, what were they trying to do? Just sped up the economy or drain?
Well, the incentive was to print money. The incentive was to rehypothecate, and they could rehypothecate because they could. There's nothing to stop them from rehypothecating, and you just get this runaway rehypothecation effect because once you can establish the central bank, you can start to print money to prevent upstarts and to consolidate your monopoly on the infinite rehypothecation.
I don't know. I hate big institutions, and I cannot believe that it was all so accidental. And so, to me, the motivation was to control society. If the level of production of society increases rapidly, there will be a lot of wealth. If there is a lot of wealth, people can dedicate their time to leisure, to doing other things that are more important than chasing your tail and just trying to get to the end of the month, paying every service, your taxes, and having enough food at home. And luckily, the little crumbs that you're gonna get are, oh, I went to the movies and I saw this movie, and I got, I don't know, culturally influenced by something that I really didn't believe. Or I bought the new iPhone, or I bought this new thing, and then you suddenly have in your hands a piece of tech that you don't really, well, most people don't fully know and understand how to use. That sense of gratification was quite instant and short. I think that there was a motivation to control people and society for them not to focus on what's really important, not have the time to live a life that we could have lived in a society that is quite prosperous and it should be much better than what it is.
Yeah, I 100% agree, and I'm not trying to absolve them or anything. Woodrow Wilson himself knew that he really screwed up, but I see it as like if it can be printed, it will be printed. Almost like if it can be censored, it will be censored, and you could maybe apply that to Bitcoin too. Like if it can be broken, then it will be broken, perhaps.
Probably yes. And when we started with this question, it made me think a lot about governance, which is something that I said previously. I don't think I'm a fan. I'm not smart enough to maybe say, oh yeah, I fully 100% understand how governance are trying to be implemented or how could they work in the future in Bitcoin. But it's a way of, once again, controlling and putting certain rules on certain coins for them to not be spending the way they could be otherwise. And is this difference between the rules of the government that you don't choose, or some of the rules on Bitcoin and the options that we can choose within that protocol, as long as it's backwards compatible, is that possibility of actually making a choice? not every 4 years, but all the time on how you use certain tools, a system, or how you use your government. The government shouldn't use us. We use that thing.
Yeah. All right. That's I think we'll wrap up that
Move
one there. As that was a good capstone at the end on that one. So we come to the final question. I have my hat here for a bonus question. It says, where does the yield come from? And so bonus points for funny answers I haven't heard before. I've heard a lot of answers and come up with a lot of my own, so.
I hope you heard that this answer, and this is probably the reason why I wanted to come on the podcast. One of the phrases that caught up with me when I was starting was, "The yield in Bitcoin is the friends you make along the way," and that, when I actually lived it, was like, "Yeah, definitely." I mean, my coins are not going to get multiplied. I'm not going to get an airdrop because of having big, I'm not going to, get yield. You just hold it. The value may or may not increase, but you believe in something and you keep it. Now, your life is going to change because you're going to meet amazing people. You're going to have fantastic discussions. People will help you to either, I don't know, grow garlic in your garden. That happened to me. To upgrade your node, change your network at home and have better privacy. All of those things I can guarantee will happen to you if you start hanging out with more Bitcoiners. People are good. It's fantastic. And the fact that when you start meeting other Bitcoiners, you can share in a much more free way, and discuss about things that are effectively important instead of bickering at random bullshit or talking about politics or things that are not going to change. I really appreciate it. Now, going back to the phrase, the yield in Bitcoin is the friends you make along the way, is not my phrase. The first time I heard it was from Ketan. Ketan runs Ministry of Nodes, and he does really good tutorials on how to run a Bitcoin node. So if you're interested in doing that, give it a look. Ministry of Nodes. Sorry for the plug. Sorry.
No, that's great.
And then I talked to him about it, and he's like, no, it's not my phrase. So as far as I know, or like by doing a bit of history on it, HODL, I think, was the first that said it, but I couldn't verify that one. But I love it. It's a good phrase.
Yeah, I like that one. I was unexpected. I a much more optimistic type of answer. I typically associate this question which with a lot more cynicism, because this harkens back to Alan Farrington asking where does the yield come from in the context of the DeFi yield farming phrase. So
Yes.
it originated with a much more cynical context, and those are the answers I tend to have myself when it comes to especially yield on things like US treasuries or any type of fiat instrument. But I love that answer as well. So,
Thanks, mate.
all right. So now it's time to give Planta a score here. I'm going to vibe code it in real time.
Cool, let's do it. I'm a goose, so I'm not expecting to be up there.
So I will. I like your bonus question answer a lot. So
Even though it was stolen, thank you.
it's
Thank
all.
you.
Genuine and good-hearted, good-natured as well too. So, I will give Planta a final score of 17.
Nice,
So,
nice. I think I listened to the other episodes, and I think I'm kind of not the first one, but I'm around, kind of in the middle. So that's not bad.
congratulations for making it through the Bitcoin gauntlet. And last word is yours if you'd like to shout out anything or tell people where they can find you.
You can find me on Noster. I post some of the best memes you will ever see, and I talk about my garden and pizzas. That's it. I'm not that important, so I really don't. Don't look me up. But what you should do if you're listening to this is go out there and try to meet some Bitcoiners. It will change your life. Honestly, it's the best thing you can do.
Absolutely. It's a great message. All right. Take care.
You too, mate. Thanks, Tom. Have a good one.